Now it's our weekly look at what's going on in national politics. Nevada held its Republican caucus last night, where Donald Trump won with nearly 46% of the votes. Presidential hopeful Jeb Bush dropped out of the race following last week's South Carolina primary, and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders still in a close race as the campaign moves forward.
Joining us now to talk about the latest in the race for the White House is Harry Enten, senior political writer for 538. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, let's start with the latest here. Donald Trump more or less swept the Nevada Republican caucus last night. He got about 46% of the vote, 14 delegates, and we got a little clip. Here's what he had to say about last night.
We won with highly educated. We won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated. We're the smartest people. We're the most loyal people. And you know what I really am happy about? Because I've been saying it for a long time. 46% with the Hispanics. 46%. Number one with Hispanics.
All right. I'm going to see what the pollster has to say about that. Was Trump number one with Hispanics?
The sample size, I just love Donald Trump. It's too funny to hear him spiel. But the sample size on that Hispanic cross tab was only 135 people. That's very, very small. The margin of error is at least 10 percentage points. He could have won Hispanics. Sure, it's possible. But it was a very small sample size. And not only that, even if you look, you know, I think the entrance poll had Hispanics making up 8% of all those who voted in the caucus. That comes out to being 1% of the total Hispanic population in Nevada. And the people who vote in a Republican caucus are politically very much unlike Hispanics at large. Hispanics at large tend to be much more liberal than those who would vote in a Republican caucus. So maybe he did win Hispanics, but I'm not really sure that means anything.
What are you looking at to say with certainty that, yes, Trump is winning his other in his field among Hispanics? What would you be waiting for?
I think, you know, we would like larger sample sizes, obviously. If you had a, you know, a national poll that was taken of Republican Hispanics, there are not very many of them. But if you got a large sample size of that, I think that would be something that we could say, hey, that's a real sign of it. For right now, all we're really seeing are very small sample sizes, which indicate that maybe Trump has a lead among Republican Hispanics or Hispanics who identify as Republican. But even if he has a lead among that group, Hispanics at large overwhelmingly hate him. There are any number of polls that show that. There's the NBC News Telemundo poll. There's SurveyMonkey. All of the polls that look at Hispanics, not just Republican Hispanics, but Hispanics at large, show that Donald Trump has a big problem with Hispanics in general.
So putting that aside for a second, what does last night's victory mean for the Trump campaign?
Well, I think you can take it any one way or another, right? I think the first obvious one is Trump won again. That makes 3-for-4. 3-for-4 is far better than whatever Rubio is trying to do with his 3-5-2-2 strategy. The name of the game is winning. So I think that is obviously a good thing. But I would not get out of control with it. You know, if we were to look at all of the states, if we were to take a national poll, which Morning Consult, which is a polling company, did, and they found Trump nationally at 36%, and at the same time, they found Trump at 48% in Nevada, which is obviously slightly better, but very close to how he actually did. Nevada is a good state for Trump. So the fact that he did well is really just, let's move forward from this. This clearly shows that Trump does have a lead nationally, but he still is only getting about a third of the vote, perhaps a little bit more nationally. That, of course, could change. Primaries are about momentum. So if Trump is able to use this win and vault himself in a Super Tuesday, it'd be a good thing. But I think we shouldn't get too far ahead of ourselves. This doesn't prove that Trump is inevitable by any stretch, but it does show that he is leading.
But has anyone ever won 3-for-4 and not gone on to be the nominee?
I can tell you that we've had the reverse, which is people have not won any of the first four and have gone on to be the nominee. Bill Clinton did that, for instance, in 1992. Of course, Bill Clinton is just one example. Usually, if you win early, you do go on and win the nomination. But there are plenty of instances of people who didn't win early and went on to win the nomination. And I would say one other thing is the sample size on this is incredibly small. There have only been, you know, what is it, 12 competitive nominations where no incumbent's been running since 1980. It's a very, very small sample size. And if Trump has taught us anything, is that the past rules don't necessarily apply to the future. So why should it in this particular case?
So what I saw on Twitter last night when people were ascribing the Trump win, what they put it down to was angry voters. Sometimes the word used was enraged. What do you think about that, Reid?
I mean, angry is one way to put it. I think what it really comes down to, though, is, you know, I think people have a misunderstanding potentially of what, you know, the Tea Party wave in 2010 was about, and also what Republicans want in general. I think people think, oh, the Republican Party is moving so far to the right. In fact, Trump is not that far right. I mean, he is on certain issues like immigration, but, you know, on Social Security, on taxes, on Planned Parenthood, he is a moderate. Some might even call him liberal. I think what it's really about are these group of voters who tend to be whites without a college education. That's what sort of Trump was saying. We want among the poorly educated. These whites without a college education who feel like they're being left behind, that Republicans in general are more focused on giving tax breaks, which doesn't really benefit those at the bottom of the economic ladder, and Democrats are too focused on helping minorities, which kind of leaves these white working class voters kind of stuck in the middle. And Trump is really speaking to them, clearly so. Whether or not that's a large enough group to win the nomination once it gets down to a one-on-one between Trump and somebody else, who is to say, but it's not a bad base to start off with.
And Harry, just briefly, before we do a little more pledge business, you said last night that some staffers, a staffer for Cruz or Rubio, I forget who, had said they'd be happy with a second or third place win. I don't know. Is there a way to see a second or third place as a win?
I think that the only way you win is by coming in first. I think that there's reason to be happy with second or third place, especially if you can get on a one-on-one with Trump. But winning is winning and losing is losing.
We're talking right now with Harry Enten from 538, and we'll be back with him in a bit. We're continuing our conversation about national politics with Harry Enten, senior political writer for 538. And we did, in the last week or so, we lost a candidate in the GOP field, got a little bit narrower. And that person, I guess this is a surprise, that it was Jeb Bush. And it's not that early in the race, but I mean, it's earlier than maybe one would have thought. What do you think, Harry?
I'm so sad. And Jeb tried it with the glasses, tried it without the glasses, and it just didn't seem to work out for him. I mean, this is fairly early in the race. We had three contests, and Bush is gone. I mean, his father, who first ran in 1980, made it much longer along in the process, and then obviously in 88 won, and his brother won in 2000, won the nomination. This is early. I think, though, it points to the fact that on the Republican side, they really do want an outsider. You saw that with Bush's struggles, but you also saw that with Huckabee and Santorum. These were two guys who in the past had run previously strong in the Republican primary, even if they didn't win, and this time they were both out after Iowa. So this is clearly a sign that this is a Republican base that wants a fresh face, and apparently at this point that fresh face is a 70-year-old New York businessman, but there it is.
And yeah, you know, Jeb Bush is gone, and yet Ben Carson hanging in there. What do you think? What do you think he's hoping for?
To sell more books. I don't know exactly. I mean, he did have the '80s sitcom star Kirk Cameron campaign for him out in Nevada. I guess that's something good. Kirk Cameron looks healthy enough, but but the fact that Bush dropped out, he recognized what was going on. He knew he had no shot of winning this. He ran his course, and that's what good. There's a lot of criticism to be given about Jeb Bush, but at the end of the day, you don't end up running for president in the position that he did without being a good politician. He is a good politician. This just wasn't his time, and good politicians recognize when it's time to fold them. Ben Carson is not a good politician. Ben Carson's in it for other reasons, it would seem at this point, than trying to win, and people who aren't good politicians tend to stick far past their due date. And I don't know why Ben Carson's still in it, but who really knows? At this point, he's really not pulling a large share of the vote anyway.
Well, let's switch over to the Democratic side. We've got a primary in South Carolina coming up Saturday ahead of Super Tuesday. What can we expect to see there for Clinton and Sanders?
I mean, Clinton is going to win that by, 20, 25, 30 points, 35 points, depending on the poll you're looking at. Sanders has pretty much given up on that state. It's a state that has a large African-American population and a state that in which the majority of Democratic voters will be African-American. And Hillary Clinton's strength, her firewall in this primary season so far, has been African-Americans. She won them by 54 percentage points in Nevada. In Nevada, they make up a much smaller share of the vote than they do in South Carolina. And so she's going to do extremely well there. And my guess, based upon the polling, is that she will be able to take those African-American base and do very well on Super Tuesday next Tuesday. So expecting a large victory for Clinton in South Carolina.
Been seeing a fair bit of press in the last week or so about Sanders' past and his record being arrested to protest segregation. Is that kind of thing, do you think, going to get him any headway with African-American voters?
I don't think anyone questions that Bernie Sanders is a liberal on any number of things, or progressive, or whatever term that is now being used to describe someone who is left of center. But there is a difference between being a liberal on certain issues and emphasizing certain issues. And I think Bernie Sanders has really fallen into a trap that Clinton has sort of set for him, and I think she's kind of found her voice, where they say that Sanders is really a one-issue candidate. That is, he talks about economic injustice. He talks about the corporate control of politics and the money in politics. And Clinton, on the other hand, has really made an emphasis of not just focusing on economic injustice, but focusing on racial injustice, on injustice within the LGBTQ community. And I think that voters, Democratic voters, know her. Black voters know her. They trust her on racial issues, and that's why she's doing so well with them.
And here we are, we're less than a week away from Super Tuesday. What are you going to be looking for from both sides over the next few days?
I mean, for Sanders, is can he win more than a few states on Super Tuesday? Can he compete in the Deep South? He's going to win in Vermont, obviously, on Super Tuesday, but there's a real question about whether he'll win in many other places besides Vermont. Maybe the Minnesota caucuses could be decent for him. Massachusetts, which is near Vermont, could be decent for him. But Clinton is going to rack up a huge delegate lead in the South where a majority of the voters will be African-American, and that pledged delegate lead could be large enough to pretty much put this race away, even if Sanders sticks in it. On the Republican side, is Ted Cruz going to make it past next Tuesday? Texas is voting. He'll probably win there, although there are some polls that indicate that his lead there isn't as large as you might think. And then there have been a number of polls from other southern states, such as Oklahoma and Georgia, where he is running third to Donald Trump in first and Marco Rubio in second. And that puts a big hole in his strategy of using the SEC primary, the southern states, to propel him forward. If he finishes third in a number of those states, there's going to be some pressure on him to get out of the race.
Harry, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer for 538. He joined us for a look at the latest in national politics. Earlier this month, teams from 12 states descended on Lake Geneva for Winterfest and the 2016 U.S. National Snow Sculpting Competition.
Each team of artists works tirelessly for 3 days, shaping things like 9-foot-tall snow blocks into works of art featuring Norse gods, robots, and even a scene from The Wizard of Oz.
The team that wins the U.S. National Competition also has the opportunity to go on to the International Championship.
A Wisconsin team won. Joining us now is David Andrews of Wauwatosa. He's a member of the first place team at the 2016 U.S. National Snow Sculpting Competition. David, congratulations and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Well, how did you get into snow sculpting?
Well, about 30 years ago, I was a sophomore in high school. And at that point, the national competition was held at the Milwaukee County Zoo. And I went to check it out, and I was just blown away. And I remember that feeling that I got of seeing it for the first time of, this is so cool, you know, being a sophomore in high school. And that that awe and that feeling has stayed with me all this time.
Well, you work as an artist for your day job. How does that work kind of affect the work you do as a snow sculptor?
Well, the work I do, I work at an art restoration company, Conrad Schmidt Studios, and a lot of the work that we do is very enjoyable, but we're meeting a need, or we're doing something that's appropriate for a space. We do interior design for churches and theaters. I do a lot of murals, but it's nice to have that wide open creative expression with snow sculpting. You know, we think about our ideas all year long, and we're sketching, and you know, it's nice to be able to express ourselves.
So you and your teammates, who are from the Eau Claire area, as I understand it, you had this big block of snow. What did you decide this year to create out of it?
Well, there's a number of people that I carve with. There's my buddies from Eau Claire, but this year I was carving with Gina Diliberti and Zach Ruder from the Milwaukee area. And the title of our piece was The Doormaster. And it's this grizzled, old, bearded man in the middle of a series of wormholes that he's opening up and controlling, and there's different dimensions, kind of portals kind of opening up around him.
Wow.
So it kind of looks like he's in the middle of a roller coaster. So, you know, the kind of it's a little bit of a geeky subject matter, but we had a lot of fun with it.
And you did that with snow. I mean, it's hard just to visualize, but you made that happen with snow. How did you get there from this 9-foot-tall block of snow to this incredible vision you had for the Doormaster?
Well, every team does a little bit differently. Our technique is we refer to our scale model. And we have a clay model that 1 inch on the clay model equals 1 foot on the sculpture. And so the first day, even though we're really anxious to get in there and carve all these details, we're painstakingly plotting the dimensions and, you know, transferring the information almost mathematically.
So what's in the snow sculptor's toolkit? What do you actually do the sculpting with?
Well, we start out with some common ice, like sidewalk ice scrapers. They're basically like oversized chisels. And we also use some big saws, like 5-foot saws. A lot of tools are handmade. Once we get the bulk of the material off, then we're into wood carving chisels, and truss plate connectors are excellent sanding devices. When we get down to the final details, we can use belt sander, paper, and if the weather is right, we can get a super smooth finish where it almost looks like marble.
Wow. So how long does this whole process take to go from this block of snow into the finished product?
Well, we start carving Wednesday morning, and we finish up Saturday around 11. So it's up to us to put our time in. You know, a lot of people work at night, and so I think it ends up being about 30 to 40 hours per person, and there's 3 people on a team. So
sleeping happens in there somewhere?
I'm sorry?
Does sleeping happen in there anywhere?
Yeah, you know, the first couple days you try and not party too much, and it's always nice because we're a lot of the other teams and other sculptors we've known for 20 years, so a lot of people call it snow camp, or it's like a snow reunion. It's nice to see everybody, but you try and keep the partying to a minimum, and then the last night is the big push where we all get sleep deprived.
Do you ever feel kind of bittersweet about the fact that you're going to spend 30, 40 hours on this beautiful thing with your team, and then it just melts, and it's so, I guess, transient?
That's interesting. You know, nothing lasts forever, I guess. But I think that's part of the reason why I liked it so much when I first saw it way back when, is that there's something so precious and delicate about it. And you know, so I guess there's kind of a zen non-attachment thing going on, but it helps to take good photos.
Mm. We're talking to David Andrews, member of the first place team at the 2016 U.S. National Snow Sculpting Competition held in Lake Geneva. Speaking of photos, we've got one on the WPR.org website. Search around for Central Time, and you'll find a picture of the doorkeeper there. So, David, Lake Geneva, is that the big event here in the U.S. When it comes to snow sculpting?
Yeah, that's the there are a lot of state-sanctioned events all over the country, and this is where the winners of those events come to carve. there is a great international event in Breckenridge, and we are thinking about applying for that next year. Getting it's a 5-person team, so we'll get all the gang together and apply for that.
What would that be like if, at the Breckenridge competition? It's 5-person team, so does that mean you create something that's even bigger?
Yeah, and I think the blocks are 10 by 10 by 10. And, you know, it involves a lot of coordination with everyone. And, I've carved that big a size before. I've never been to Breckenridge, but we're looking forward to it.
Now, if somebody's thinking, on the off chance that we get some snow yet this winter in Wisconsin, I want to make my own snow sculpture. Can amateurs do this? What would be your advice to come up with just a front yard snow sculpture?
Yeah, you can take a garbage can. Hopefully the weather is just right. It helps if the snow is packing snow. You can pack a garbage can, turn it upside down, and if it freezes overnight, if it gets below freezing, then it'll freeze up and firm up for you. And, you know, you can take some wood chisels, you can take some, you know, paint scrapers or whatever you have around that you think might work. And, you know, I'm sure everyone's seen good yard sculptures that people have kind of thrown together. The other thing you could do is just, you know, basically like if you're making a snowman, you build it additively and just kind of stick it on.
If it's not packing snow, is there anything you can do to get better material to work with? I don't know, spritz it maybe with water or something?
Not really. I mean, if it's dry, if it's not packing snow, the snow still will stick together. You can stomp it into a trash can and then and let it sit overnight, you know, in your trash can, and then the next day it should be fused together enough.
Hmm. Now, we talked about your winning entry this year. What have been some of your favorite snow sculptures in years past?
Ooh, there have been so many. I probably carved about 100 myself, and I've seen so many. Maybe talk about a few that stick in my brain. In Lake Geneva, the forms are cylindrical. So one of the great teams that I think ever was a team from Alaska, and they did this ingenious setup where they had a bird cage, and they made it a cylindrical bird cage. They carved the bars, and then they took one of the bars out so they could kind of get in there and carve a parrot inside, and it was beautifully carved parrot. And then when they were all done, they put the bar back, and it was just a beautiful, smart piece. There have been so many. I mean, if you can Google, I'm sure you'll see some amazing stuff.
Do you have any particular ideas on your wish list for what you'd like to make next?
Ooh, that's top secret. I can't tell you
that. Oh,
trade secrets. Okay, I respect that.
Yeah.
So, and this is, you mentioned there's an international competition. I think I saw something about there's a big international one in Japan sometimes, too. So this is not just a Midwestern or an American thing. People from all over the world are making these snow sculptures.
Yeah, and I think it started in Europe. And Winterfun Corporation, 35 years ago, I believe, saw that and decided to bring it to Milwaukee. And Don Berg and Gene Kempfer, Don had the nationals at the Milwaukee County Zoo, and then Gene Kempfer actually had we hosted a international event that was at the then PAC downtown. So it was nice to have that in our backyard. But there are events going on around the world, and some of my teammates have gone to Italy. There's an Illinois team that we carved with in Lake Geneva that was on their way to Canada. And, people have gone to Russia, China, Switzerland, all over the place.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you very much.
That was 2016 National Snow Sculpting Champion David Andrews telling us about his winning team in this year's competition in Lake Geneva.